We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Brian Dawson.
Joining me today, my guest is Dr. Joseph Gerson. He's the Director of Programs and the Director of Peace and Economic Security Program in the American Friends Service Committee in New England, an international authority of U.S. foreign policy and military policy with considerable experience in the Middle East. And the last time we were on the show, we talked about the Armitage and Nye report and the Asian pivot, and you predicted that Shinzo Abe, Prime Minister of Japan, would try to possibly go through Article 96 to change the Constitution, or he would reinterpret the meaning of Article 9, which it seems to be the case today. So your thoughts on Abe's move. Why is he doing this? How is this in the interest for Japan, or is it, to change Article 9 of the Constitution?
Yeah, well, so in terms of Abe, you know, we need to understand who this man is and what his political ambitions have been for many years. And he is the grandson of one of what more than 20 leading Japanese who were charged as Class A war criminals. His grandfather was not prosecuted, but instead nurtured by the CIA. His political career was nurtured to the point where he became Prime Minister of Japan, and in 1960 hammered through the extension of the U.S.-Japan alliance, allowing U.S. Military forces to remain, you know, now for, what, over 50 years. And Abe's goal has been to undo, to reverse as much of the post-war order as he could. He's been dedicated to revising the Constitution, but as people throughout the region have seen and have been profoundly disturbed by, he threatened to review the apology for the sexual slavery committed by the Japanese government during the what for them was the 15-year war. He has raised questions about whether the invasion of China and other countries was aggression, and he has moved to appoint people with just extreme right-wing views to have senior positions in the national media. I mean, just mind-boggling views that go back to military Shinto. What he's done now with the reinterpretation, I think, needs to be understood as a political coup, in large measure encouraged by the United States. Abe's goal was to revise the Constitution in a formal manner, but I think the United States and others perceive that if this happened, that would be too great an affront to China to let go by. And so the strategy of reinterpreting the Constitution was brought forward. It meant some changing in personnel, hard negotiations with coalition partner party. But in the event, in opposition to the vast majority of the Japanese people, and in violation of the Constitution itself, the decision was made that black is now white, that a country that has forsworn war as a way to deal with international conflicts and will not have military capabilities, will now basically be able to function militarily on a global basis.
They're calling it.
Sorry?
They're calling it collective defense.
It's
so they can join in other military operations. So they could join the U.S. in Afghanistan, for example.
Right. They could also, it's interesting because until recently, the assumption was that this was only to be in conjunction with the United States. And as part of that process now, the Japanese yesterday appointed a high-level member of their Maritime Self-Defense Forces, as it's called, to actually serve on Hagel's staff in the Pentagon. And so you see the deepening integration of the U.S. and Japanese militaries, which are already pretty deeply integrated. But if you look at what's been happening in the statements made over the last couple of months, what you find is that the Abe government has also said that this collective security can apply to governments with close relations to Japan. And so while on one hand they're deepening the client relationship with the United States, On the other hand, they're moving so they can move unilaterally, say, in this case, against China because of disputes between the Philippines and China. And the rationale in the very vaguely worded statement, I've read it, it's really quite remarkable, essentially says that challenges to Japan's what they describe as survival of security, such as threats to the oil supply coming from the Persian Gulf, would be appropriate for Japan to go to war. There's also, if you follow that logic, the ability to launch first strike attacks potentially against North Korea.
Yeah. You mentioned the island disputes with the Philippines and China, or also Vietnam and China. They had some protests in Vietnam where, this is ridiculous, but collectively Chinese were blamed, so some of their bicycle shops, factories were attacked and burned, and I think 18 people died.
Right.
But that could be a bellicose for war.
It could be. Depending on how deep the Japanese and Vietnamese relations go. And of course, the possibility, the consequences of a war in that region would be catastrophic. It's also interesting. I find myself focusing on the assault on democracy and constitutional basis of government here. I mean, I think one can now question whether or not Japan is a constitutional democracy. It's interesting. The Asahi Shimbun, kind of the leading, if you will, liberal newspaper in Japan, kind of the equivalent of the New York Times, has warned that this same process could be used to undermine human rights, noting that the LDP, Abe's party, has already developed a alternative constitution that they'd like to have passed. And if they can reinterpret the military policy, why can't they reinterpret the constitution in terms of human rights?
Also, a cabinet resolution is not the legal way to change the constitution. They're supposed to have which should pass both houses, and then they have to have a referendum from the public,
right.
And the public doesn't support changing Article 9 or reinterpreting or whatever they want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a political coup. It's a violation of the Constitution. The Constitution says that a new amendment revision has to be approved by 2/3 of both the lower and the upper houses, and then put to majority vote by the people. Last polling indicated that more than 55% of the Japanese people opposed it. Abe has compared what he's done to the Meiji Restoration, the most important political revolution, one of the two most important political revolutions in Japan since the 1860s.
Well, I mean, that, of course, he can't even say sex slaves either. He says comfort women. But
yeah.
They're just playing around with language, because what they would say is, well, we're not having an amendment, so we don't have to have that process, because it's not an amendment. It's just a reinterpretation.
Yeah.
It's still changing the Constitution, of course.
Yeah. I mean, it changes the foundations of Japanese society. And, you know, there are other dimensions here that we have to be concerned about, not only in Japan, but many other countries in Asia and around the world, what transpires in education policy, the building of nationalism, the failure to teach basic history. And so this, especially in Japan, in relationship to rising generations, has had a huge impact, and Abe's been playing on it.
It's also hurt relations with South Korea and China as well, because their right-wing equivalents can point to what Abe's doing and bolster their own base.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long history of, you know, kind of the hardliners on different sides of tensions reinforcing one another, and that's certainly happening in this case. I think also worth noting in the Asahi Shimbun editorial, they note that the greatest threat to Japan's security comes from North Korea, and that in order to maintain security, Japan needs to have good relations with both China and South Korea. This reinterpretation of the Constitution, you know, is, if you will, the capstone action of a series of policies that have really deepened policies and statements that have really deepened the schisms between Japan and its neighbors.
Collective defense is saying, we didn't learn anything from the First World War. Yeah, I mean, they're looking for pretexts. How does the U.S. benefit from this other than selling more airplanes or whatever to Japan? Do they have a larger geopolitical move in this?
Well, you know, it's there's short-term tactical gains, and I think long-term, you know, catastrophes involved here. So for the United States, it's been pressing since 1950, the Korean War, for Japan to reconstitute its military and to become an ally along the lines of, say, NATO allies. And it's U.S.'s pursuit of policy throughout, and the Japanese elite that it's been working with, what might be called salami tactics, a little bit at a time. In the 1980s, there was the pressure for Japan to join peacekeeping operations and build a military capacity to do that. Their military began to have experience in moving to distant places, and it helped prepare the Japanese people psychologically and culturally for the deployment of their troops. You know, this grows to the deployment of some in the Japanese army to Iraq, basically swaddled in the Australian military, so there'd be no casualties. But again, preparing the Japanese people. You had the support of the U.S.-Afghan war with the provision of oil and other resources by the Japanese Navy. Step at a time, step at a time. For the United States, it's a way to augment its global power projection. And in the context now of the sequester and recent reports about the inability of the Navy to fund the replacement of the Ohio-class submarines, the ones that carry the Trident nuclear weapons, in recent reports from Center for International Strategic Studies. The sense is that if they can further integrate the Japanese military and Japanese military technology into that of the United States, then it's augmented. We can reinforce the encirclement of China. We can back our demands on China with greater coercive threats. And of course, the Chinese are having none of this. They're in turn building their military, incredibly sharp confrontations over the Senkaku Daiyu Islands, which could lead, and they could spark a catastrophic global, potentially even nuclear war.
Yeah, they're out there playing chicken with the patrol boats and things. It's ridiculous.
Oh, it's if you look at the photographs, there's one photograph that we use, which shows Japanese and Chinese warships and Taiwanese fishing boats in extremely close proximity. I mean, at the point you can't tell which boat is which, you know, whose country. So the possibilities of a collision, of an accident, of something worse happening there is quite great. And in a talk, a presentation at Harvard several months ago, Ezra Vogel, who was the head of Asian intelligence at the State Department under the first Clinton administration, looked at that picture and he said, you know, in this circumstance, if there's an incident, we can have no confidence that escalation can be capped. So it's a very, very dangerous situation. And you know, in what C. Wright Mills called the crackpot realism, you have the U.S. kind of reinforcing this military presence, this military pressure on China, while at the same time trying to navigate U.S.-Chinese relations in a way that doesn't lead to war. So the contradictions are huge. I mean, at this point, the carriers in China for the strategic and economic talks, and it's a complicated relationship.
Well, it's not as scary as if John McCain goes to visit somewhere, because everywhere he visits has a revolution bought and paid for.
Yeah. Let me just say that, you know, as we're doing this critique, I think it's also important for us to be talking about, well, what are alternative policies that the U.S. could be pursuing, right?
What should they be doing?
And, you know, at the very least, you know, I think we should be taking lessons from the dynamics that led to the end of the Cold War, which was around the framework called common security. The recognition that all parties to these tensions have both legitimate fears and legitimate interests. And to name those, and in very hard-headed negotiations, to find, if you will, win-win solutions rather than zero-sum solutions. So it's interesting to read the Chinese side, their statement in today's New York Times in the economic and strategic talks, in which they say, look, the Pacific Ocean is certainly big enough for the United States and China to coexist. I think rather than making the military threats, we need to focus on how we can coexist. Now, this is not a pure pacifist view. I think we need to get beyond that. But simply to remove the most immediate dangers of war, we need to be encouraging win-win solutions between Japan and China, which would mean that reversing the statement that in a military conflict between Japan and China over the Senkaku Daiyu Islands, that we go to war on Japan's side. I mean, we need to be changing our discourse and looking for win-win situations.
Yeah, the friendships have broken down more too. There was a boat full of high school students that capsized, a South Korean boat, and over 200 of them drowned. And basically they only saved some of the crew, and a lot of the high school kids were just left there to die. But the Japanese Coast Guard was there circling it, but they weren't permitted to help. And they probably could have, they have a very good Coast Guard. But the relations had broken down such that South Korea refused to allow any help. But that would have been a chance, had the Japanese saved them and saved the children, that relations could have been mended and would have been also, they wouldn't have died. But they're so bullheaded on both sides that, because I can guarantee you, had it been a Japanese boat, they wouldn't have allowed the Koreans to help either. But they just, yeah, they let them die because of their stubbornness.
Yeah, I mean, you know, The scars of the past are deep, and the failure of the Japanese, not only government, but elite, to face what Japan did, and now the kind of remilitarization by Abe, you know, that reinforces the fears and the memories from the past, and reinforces a nationalism. So it's interesting. Angela Merkel, when she was in China, just last week, talked about the importance of facing history. She's tried to be diplomatic and not point all the fingers at Japan, but clearly this is a profound fault line in Japanese politics, and the United States has not done enough to kind of push it. I have to say that Congressman, blanking on his name, from California, a Japanese-American member of Congress who pressed the investigations and resolution on comfort women, that was a great act. And I think we have to find a way in which we don't stigmatize all Japanese, but find ways to encourage them to face their history, as Germans have and as Americans need to do. I mean, we look out there, but how many people here know the histories of, say, the Vietnam War, which we killed more than 3 million people in Indochina? In pursuit of
how many Koreans that the U.S. killed in the Korean War, or Iraqis, or Native Americans, exactly. You go all the way back.
Exactly, and in a situation where we don't have the kind of social services we need, we're not building the green infrastructure we need for the 21st century. Instead, the money's going for the military, and this is in part because we get to face the lessons of our history.
Yeah, it's hard for any country, but I think the difference is Japan lost its war. So usually the loser has to. But, yeah, I mean, of course. Some of them, though, I mean, I've talked to people who are not right-wing extremists or whatever, and they say, we have acknowledged, we did apologize, like, 50 times. How many times do we have to apologize for it? Like, I didn't do anything. I wasn't even born yet. Da-da-da. You know, that's the way they think. But then with people like Hashimoto and Abe and the crazies like that, they just make everything 1,000 times worse. Visiting war shrines and so on. They know what kind of reaction it's going to make, because there's no real gain in it. I'm going to go over here and pray. Like, do you really have to do that? I mean, but they want to thumb their nose at Korea and China because they don't want to be told what to do. It's like that level of machismo.
And they also look to reinforce, right-wing forces and structures that are already there, and to have their votes for the longer term. So you have as in almost any society, different structures within civil society, and the right-wing forces, you know, are still pretty strong in Japan. Someone, actually, the Japanese guy I work with, compared kind of Abe's approach and that ideology to that in the United States South, saying, you know, in both cases they were functionally defeated nations, and they had significant members of their elite who wanted to hold on or felt the need to hold on to the ideology of their defeated nation. And unfortunately, we see this working its way through U.S. politics, Supreme Court decisions, just the whole range. I mean, the reversal of affirmative action. It has its deep parallels to what's happening in Japan.
Interesting analogy. I mean, there's a lot of that can be said about the. That's a big topic. So we'll have to go back to Civil War or something, but. Yeah, but you, in both cases, you see regional scapegoating there, too, like between the U.S. Civil War, what we have now between Tokyo and, say, Okinawa. Okinawa is the one that has to have the bases and has to deal with the rapes and everything else, but they don't have a voice, and they're totally against it, because they have to deal with it, because in Tokyo, right. They don't. So, that, you know, they collect all the taxes, they're having the Olympics there soon, and, you know, Tokyo's on the rise. But all the other prefectures are going down.
So just to say, you know, I'm glad you raised Okinawa. I'll be going there in mid-August, and I've just been reading reports from Gavin McCormick, who's just returned from there. And also just for your viewers to call to people's attention, really excellent book by Gavin McCormick and Sotoko Norimatsu called Resistant Islands. Which is a history of political history of Okinawa and of the resistance, and one of the things that they stress in their book is that the U.S. military continued the occupation of Okinawa until 1972, and in the struggle for reversion, the slogan was reversion to the Japanese Constitution, the idea that. With the end of the U.S. military occupation, Okinawa would join an order defined by a peace constitution, Article 9, without a military. Right. That the bases would be forced to be withdrawn. But in fact, the experience of the Okinawans was precisely the opposite. The formal military occupation ended, but the concentration of U.S. bases did not. And they've learned that there was all kinds of complicity with the Japanese government and the U.S., including the continued presence of U.S. nuclear weapons in Okinawa.
It makes them more of a target, not less. Japan's not getting hit by terrorists. The U.S. might, though. So.
But in the context of the Constitution, forswearing having a military and use of war, Okinawans came to understand that. That the Constitution wasn't being honored, hadn't been honored now for decades, and that Japanese policies in many ways have been predicated on lies. Mm-hmm. Now you have a situation where, at the end of 18 years, and under increased pressure from the United States, the Abe government is moving in a profoundly illegal and brutal way to build a new U.S. Marine base at Hinako, which will assault the people, communities of Nago, assault the environment. And this is being done in against the opposition of the vast majority of Okinawan people, certainly the people of Nago, who just reelected an anti-basis mayor.
And Koizumi, who was also LDP, promised them at least six different times how he was going to move a certain number of Marines out of there, maybe to Guam, and they ended up in Darwin, Australia, and they didn't reduce the number at all. They just Tetris with troop
deployment. Right. So, reading Gavin's report, he is increasingly concerned that there will be violence by the Japanese state against Okinawans in order to build these bases. It's a very, very difficult situation, and unfortunately it gets very little attention from the international press.
There's strong resistance. I'm curious if this story made it across the pond or not, There's strong resistance to changing the constitution. We had one man at the Shinjuku station set himself on fire after giving a speech against Abe. And I was wondering if that made the news more than, say, the super typhoon or something.
It made it into the New York Times.
Okay.
I tend not to watch the television news. I'm rather doubtful. It made it there. So in the New York Times, so, you know, a particular sector of the political class here was made aware of that.
Okay.
But not beyond that.
I was reading was more on his set himself on fire rather than the speech he gave before that. But.
Right. I mean, look, it's what it reminded me of. I mean, it reminded me of two things. On the one hand, you have the kind of the right wing suicides, the long tradition in Japan. But on the other, you know, back in the early 60s in Vietnam, there were self-immolations of Buddhist monks in protest of the Diem government. And, you know, this was, you know, who knows what this individual's personal psychology was, but, you know, a profound statement against what Japan is becoming. And, you know, it's a challenge. You know, there's a popular perception of what Japan is and a relationship to that perception and an urgent necessity for people to understand not only, you know, what the Chinese government is, and there's a lot of news about that here in the United States, but also, you know, what Japan is, and to have a clear understanding of the United States' role in all this, which, as you mentioned in the introduction with the Nye Armitage report, you know, the U.S. has played profound roles here.
Yeah, pushing them to continue to be a top-tier nation.
Yes.
I don't know how many times he said top-tier. You could count it. The pressure, it was just ridiculous. But yeah, it's just not in common political discourse. All of this that was leading up to it, for most people, it started this month or last month. It's suddenly, what? They're changing the Constitution? And there were protests and things in Japan. Thousands of people, I would say, which is a lot here for your protest. It's not like France or something where you protest because for everything, but no real coverage, and it's a very, very serious move because I don't think Japan really wants to go to war. I don't think China does either. I don't think anybody's that stupid. It's mutual annihilation, but it just sort of can happen when you have boats playing chicken and things like that.
You know, this get my month straight here. The end of last month marked, you know, the assassination in Sarajevo in 1914 that triggered the First World War. And unfortunately, there are more similarities between the current situation in East Asia and the situation in Europe in 1914 than most of us want to think about, right? So you have the really deep nationalism on all sides. You have territorial disputes. You have arms races with new technologies. You have got wild card actors like Abe and Kim Jong-un up in North Korea. It's a dangerous situation. And while nobody wants war, a combination of miscalculations or simply kind of political calculations. So, you know, one of the things that I've written about and try to help people remember was that at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was probably the closest we ever came to human annihilation.
It was a lot closer than people know.
Over the principle that we could surround Russia with nuclear weapons, missiles, even obsolete ones in Turkey, but they couldn't have them in the Caribbean, Secretary McNamara warned that inevitably they're going to have the capability to hit us, you know, within a decade, and Kennedy, JFK turned to his brother at one point, it's recorded, and said, you know, if I hadn't gone to this nuclear alert, I would have been impeached. So, you know, with the pressures of nationalism in China, in Japan, if you hit a crisis, politicians may not feel that they're in a position to fight against the popular force and rather go with it. And that's one of the dangers that we have to be concerned about, I think.
I think for Abe, he actually is ideologically sold. Like, he's not Kennedy being forced into it. He's a He's more like his brother. He was all into it.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, Kennedy was a great cold warrior. I mean, we there's the myth around him. But even if you're a hardliner, you know, when it comes to facing missiles coming back at you, you know, sometimes, you know, realism strikes. And at that point, one of the elements you have to deal with is popular, you know, popular emotions and popular movements. So, I mean, and again, coming back to what you had said earlier in relationship to Vietnam, I'm sure the Vietnamese government did not want those riots and the murders and attacks, you know, on the Chinese population in Vietnam. But emotions were high, nationalism was strong. People felt that their national honor, even their future, had been compromised.
And it was collectivism. I mean, those Chinese people didn't do anything, but they were Chinese, so exactly. It's like the collective punishment in Gaza right now. It's like, well, they're all brown, so let's get them. And there are also Japanese restaurants and cars and things smashed up in China because they're just from Japan. That was the only reason they needed. So this sick sense of nationalism, xenophobia, racism, all those forms of collectivism are just coming from people watching TV and saying, wait, I'm on this team. It's like sports teams. They just, you know, but that's my team, you know. They're not like me. But it is really immature, but these are adults, and this is how they behave. So.
Yeah. Well, this is how they behave, but then, you know, others like you, I, and others, you know, do our best to engage with people, you know, to help people think about, you know, our common humanity and the possibility of common security and of coexistence, because the alternative isn't very good.
Yeah, I'm hoping maybe they can find some avenues outside of politics, sports, something where they can start to get along, K-pop, whatever. Where they go, this sounds silly, but there are a lot of people that warm up to Korea or Japan because of arts, because of the arts or because of athletics.
Right. There are also, yeah, I know people in Japan's main islands, teachers and others, you know, who have taken delegations of young people over to China, you know, doing the work of exposing them to the underside of Japan's history, and building relations with, you know, with Chinese. I think we need more of this.
Starting with the schools where it's possible. Mm-hmm. But they'd almost have to pay out of pocket for that. If you're at least in Osaka, it would never happen. With the money they got. But.
Yeah. And one of the people I know who did it was a man who nearly won the mayor election in Kyoto.
Okay. Kyoto's cool. I mean, they're fine. Kyoto and Narumiya, all right. Then they get over towards Osaka and Kobe area. You start getting... What happened there was just these lunatics got in charge on a one-issue pony after the tsunami. They just said, we're going to cut off nuclear power. We're going to cut off nuclear power. Yeah. And people were very afraid of nuclear power because of the disaster. So they just sort of unthinkingly voted on the one issue and they ended up with Hashimoto and Nakahara and these guys. Yeah, and then, of course, the only reactor that was not shut down in all of Japan was Osaka. Yeah. So even that they lied about. So they finally got it off now, but it was the last one stayed on for another year before everyone else. And yeah. But once they're in, it's very hard to get away because it's nepotism. They purchase loyalty by, you know, gathering taxes and just increasing people's salaries if they obey and getting rid of them if they don't. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm in Boston, which has a long history of that.
Oh, yeah. Gangs run it all. It is mob style, though. And I believe Abe, well, you talked about his grandfather, father, too. Allegations of Yakuza connections. So it's very deep here. The mafia in Japan is not like the kind of mob you see in Hollywood in the U.S., the Casa Nostra. It's very deep because it had CIA ties post-World War II on. It had very big backers.
Yeah, well, I mean, it probably goes back even before that, I mean, in terms of the integration with the Japanese elite. You know, there are a few books published here on the Yakuza, and, you know, it is a different operation.
A lot of them get banned here.
Yeah. Yeah, the other thing that's sort of interesting, you know, there was the, I'm blanking on the name of the Japanese camera company, but there was a huge scandal over, I think, Olympia, a camera company, which had a brought in an English CEO who stumbled across this incredible corruption, and you know it leads back in part to ties with Yakuza, and I have to say, as I've kind of looked at Japan's economic stagnation, you have to wonder to what degree some of these Yakuza ties are not an element of that in the economic culture there.
They run real estate in Osaka, and they've got a bunch of scams going on, and I can explain how they work and what they're doing, but so, you know, the old Zaibatsu. But it's so hard to change because it's so integrated with local governments and things that everyone knows, and this is the way it is.
It's like
D.C.
Yeah, well, it's similar and different. Yeah. So anyhow, just to say that, you know, coming back to our original focus here on the Constitution, my understanding is, you know, as they say, it ain't over till the fat lady sings. And while there's the reinterpretation, I think the next lines of struggle are going to be around the legislation to implement these.
I think that they probably do have enough votes in the House because they've bribed off their little partner coalitions.
Right, right.
But they will never pass a referendum because of it.
You know, and even with Kometo having, you know, maybe I will say predictably, gone cheap. Popular struggle. I mean, if you don't struggle, there's no chance of winning. If you struggle, sometimes things happen. So my hope is that there'll be considerable insistence that black is black and white is white, that words have their meaning, and that people in Japan can build their lives on the foundation of the Constitution that they thought they had.
I think they will block the change this time, but just even trying to attempt it has wrecked relations with their neighbors.
Oh, yeah,
at least
for sure.
China, South Korea, North Korea.
For sure.
It may have bolstered relations with the Philippines and Vietnam because they have equal prejudices towards China, and that goes both ways. This is just not the way any of them need to be behaving.
Yeah.
It's just,
but, no, it's not good. It's not good.
No. Well, I appreciate your time, and hopefully I won't have to have you on again to explain a disaster. Maybe we can talk about something that worked.
Maybe we can talk about victories. That would be nice.
Yeah, it would be good. It could happen. I hope so. And I guarantee you it's going to start in Okinawa. It's going to be the center of it.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to going back and joining and doing a little bit I can to kind of help people there.
What's like Japan's Hollywood? They have a disproportionate number of singers, actors. They're all Okinawans that have a voice, and they kind of stick together and say, no war. Nothing. And so they have a disproportionate voice to the rest of Japan, but politically, based on population and money, that Tokyo doesn't care. So.
They just have to make it impossible to build those bases.
Yeah, get enough pressure.
Right. Okay, well, take care.
Take care.
All right, be well.
Sayonara.